KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Really, this is going to be the first social media conclave, so we got to worry about the Pope's name leaking out before it's formally announced.
I'll have the summer to enjoy sweet peas, and by golly, there are going to be millions of them. I will tell you right now.
I mean, I became hurt because I needed to sort of confront my worst fears in a way. And the Khmer Rouge seemed to represent everything that I was, you know, everything that was evil and wrong, everything that we've been taught to be afraid of.
It's photojournalist Nick Dunlop talking about the Khmer Rouge. You'll hear more from him in about 15 minutes coming up here on KUOW. Marty Wingett talking about sweet peas in the garden. Almost time to think about that. It is Tuesday, time for our Green Days panel. And we started all that off with the possibility that Twitter would scoop the white smoke coming out of the Vatican chimney when the new pope is announced. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in for a couple of weeks for Steve Scher. He's on vacation. Pope Benedict will hold his final weekly public audience tomorrow before he steps down. And the jockeying has already begun for who will replace him. Who is next to head the Catholic Church? Do American Catholics even care? Joining us with more is Jamie Manson. She holds a Master's of Divinity from the Yale Divinity School, and she studied Catholic theology there and sexual ethics with Sister Margaret Farley. Her weekly column, Grace in the Margins, appears in the National Catholic Reporter. Hello, Jamie Manson. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tomorrow is the last weekly audience, and then what happens to Pope Benedict?
Well, we were told today that he will become His Holiness Pope Benedict XVI Emeritus. So they have actually, we are in such uncharted waters with this situation that they actually had to think of a title. We also learned that he will no longer be wearing his signature red shoes, but will be wearing a pair of brown shoes that he was given on a visit to Mexico.
Huh.
That's what we know.
And
yeah.
And because there really hasn't been a Pope Emeritus, we don't know what a Pope Emeritus, I mean, it's not like he's going to be a Pope advisor or anything.
They're saying no, that he will. He's moving out of his papal apartment on the 28th. He will move to Castel Gandolfo, which is just outside of the Vatican, and will lead, what I'm understanding to be really a monastic life, a life of prayer and study.
Well, it's interesting to even think about that because it's been hundreds of years since a pope actually quit his job. So we'll have to watch that. But I understand that there's a lot of pressure to get a new pope into office before Easter, which is, you know, not that long from now. So what is going to happen? How is this going to be sped up?
Well, apparently the news today is that the Pope did change the rules. He's been changing a lot of rules lately. It's sort of an interesting time, what rules they change and what they don't. But he did change the rules to bring the date closer. And so the word is today that it may start of March 4th, which is pretty soon. But I do think it's, I'm not sure how auspicious it is to think that it can be done by Easter. And you know, it's also such a busy time for clerics, so it's going to be quite a situation they have there.
So what happens who comes together to pick a new pope? How does that work?
Only the cardinals can come together, those that have been appointed cardinals. There are, I think, 117 of them were available to vote. That's now down to 115 because, what made very big news yesterday, the Cardinal Keith O'Brien from Scotland had to decline being in the conclave because complaints came across that he was sexually abusing men over the last 20 years. And then another cardinal came forward and said that he just can't make it. He's just too old. So you have to be one of the cardinals, and you also have to be under the age of 80 to vote.
How many of the cardinals are? So there's 115 of them
115,
are in?
115, right.
So they come to the Vatican to do this?
They do, and they have a large mass. You know, Catholicism is a very ritualistic religion, and so they have a very large ritual. And then, in essence, they lock themselves away in the Sistine Chapel, which is really its first purpose. And they deliberate all day. And then when they're done deliberating for the day, I guess they go back, they share meals, and they go back to wherever they're staying. And then every day that they don't settle on a man, they send up black smoke through the chimney of the Sistine Chapel, and then the day that they do, we'll see white smoke, and we'll be told Habemus Papam, which means we have a pope.
Or somebody might tweet it out of the Sistine Chapel.
Well, that's a question. Apparently, they're trying to freeze out. I forget what number, but a substantial number of cardinals do have a Twitter account. So this again, so many uncharted territory waters that were this bark that is the church is floating around and trying to plot a course desperately, and so they're trying to freeze out any access to social media.
Huh. I'm assuming that it's all men. There are no female cardinals that I know of.
You are correct. Yes, and that's an interesting situation. You know, is that we have a system that was not created by women. Women have had no input into. Decisions will be made without the input of women or without women at all. You know, the Catholic Church chooses from its applicant pool this tiny, tiny fraction of the human race, which is, you know, men who claim that they can stay celibate for the rest of their lives. And you wonder if any other organization in the world, you know, chose their leadership from such a small pool, how it would function. And I think that that's finally catching up with them.
I have heard and read a lot about how the new pope might be from Africa, South America, or Asia. So what do you hear, I guess?
That's, you know, all part of the swirling rumors every day, you know, that we're hearing. You know, the one that was probably most prominent was Cardinal Turkson in Ghana. But his star fell pretty quickly. He did an interview with Christiane Amanpour not long after the retirement announcement, you know, and it essentially said that sex abuse will not be a problem in Africa ever because we don't support homosexuality in our traditions. And given, you know, the struggle we're having over either the inclusion of gay people in the church and the struggle, the ongoing saga, you know, the scandal of clerical sex abuse, that did not do much for his cause.
So do you think that we might see a more liberal pope than Pope Benedict was was considered to be when he was elected?
You know, that's always the hope because, I mean, we're obviously in a church that's desperate for transformation. There's a radical shortage of priests globally. People are hemorrhaging, you know, from the church. You know, people are leaving the church, particularly in the West and even in parts of Latin America and South America. The problem is that the cardinals that will do this voting were almost all handpicked by John Paul II or Benedict XVI, and they have both been very traditional men. And so the likelihood that we'll get a more liberal pope is not great. But, you know, we all are open to the workings of the Holy Spirit.
The last time you were on this program, you talked about the pressure that's been put on nuns worldwide, particularly activist nuns. So it doesn't sound as if there's a lot of possibility that the next pope will be more open to activism, social activism.
Well, you know, one can hope, but certainly, you know, the struggle over the crackdown on the Leadership Conference of Women Religious was that, you know, as the church is doing in most cases, it was focusing on a few pelvic zone issues. And this has been the great turnoff in the West, you know, about the Roman Catholic Church is this fixation on, you know, that one defines whether or not one is Catholic based on how they think about, you know, gay people and the women, you know, being able to be ordained. And so the church kind of, you know, did the same thing and ignored the activism that they've been doing. Now, I think the institutional church was rather taken aback by how strongly people responded. I think that they sort of thought that, well, no one will care. Nobody really cares about nuns anymore. But the swell of support, you know, across the nation for nuns, I think made them take a step back. And so they've been very quiet right now on that issue.
And that brings me to a last question, which is, I know that there are American cardinals who will travel to Rome, but in general, do American Catholics care as much about who's elected pope as perhaps the close followers in Europe or Africa or Asia?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, we have about 77 million Catholics in the United States, and about two-thirds no longer participate really in the life of the church anymore. And so much of that disaffection has to do with, you know, the church's seeming preoccupation with gay people and women and making sure they're feeling excluded from the church. And so I think there's disaffection. But I think, you know, Catholics are tend to be people of hope, and you know that they'll be watching it. But whether or not, I think they'll think it has effect on their day-to-day lives, you know, probably not. But there are many places in the world where the church is still very, very powerful, in good ways and in not so good ways. You know, and so, and that's something, you know, if we're going to be in solidarity with everyone who's facing injustice, then we really should be concerned about who takes on leadership in this church.
Jamie Manson writes a weekly column in the National Catholic Reporter called Grace on the Margins. Thanks so much for being with us, and that papal conclave starts on Monday.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekday.
Forty-four degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Forecast says mostly cloudy all day with an afternoon high of 48.
We all know about America's love affair with processed foods and its effect on our health. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Moss takes us inside food industry research labs where scientists develop snacks we just can't resist.
There have been studies showing that the more noise a potato chip makes, the more you're going to be attracted to it and eat.
His new book is Salt, Sugar, Fat. Join us.
Tonight at 8 o'clock on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2.
KUOW and Evergreen City Ballet present Tea for Ruby, an original ballet for children at multiple venues March 2nd through the 30th. Illustrator Robin Price Glasser from the Fancy Nancy book series will sign books at the Maidenbauer performances March 2nd and 3rd. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
It's 10:16. I'm Bernard Ouellette. We'll convene our organic gardening panel to get some expert gardening advice in 15 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. From 1975 to 1979, the communist movement Khmer Rouge ran the country of Cambodia. Comrade Doik ran one of their interrogation prisons. It was a place called Tuol Slang, commonly known as S-21. And while he was there, Doik oversaw the rape, torture, and death of more than 14,000 Cambodians before he fled into hiding. In 2010, the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia put Doik on trial. He was the first Khmer Rouge official tried and convicted for crimes against humanity, murder, and torture. Katie Sewell joins me now to pick up that story.
Comrade Doik's original sentence of 35 years, as you might imagine, outraged Cambodians, Marcy. That would mean he only served about 25 minutes for each person that he harmed. But in February of 2012, that sentence was increased by a UN war crimes tribunal to life in prison with no further chance of appeal. Now, Comrade Doik might have stayed in hiding his entire life if photojournalist Nick Dunlop hadn't discovered his hiding place and coaxed a confession out of him with the help of his journalist friend Nate Thayer. Nick went looking for Doik to try to understand how a person could change from a respected schoolteacher into someone capable of killing his mentors and even his relatives. I asked Nick Dunlop how his journey to find Doik started out.
I came across an article in the National Geographic, images of mass graves that had just been unearthed. And I think it was the first place to really make me realize that the world wasn't quite the place that I thought it was. I mean, I'd grown up in a very sheltered childhood in Ireland, and it almost seemed like I'd been sort of deceived that somehow there was this other world of pain and suffering out there, and I had absolutely no experience or understanding of it, and that terrified me.
You say in your book that, this is a quote, Cambodia became shorthand for all that was wrong in the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that, it was so extreme. It was so beyond my scope of understanding and experience. I mean, I became hurt because I needed to sort of confront my worst fears in a way. And the Khmer Rouge seemed to represent everything that I was, everything that was evil and wrong, everything that we'd been taught to be afraid of was sort of symbolized and represented by the horrors of the killing fields.
So you went after Comrade Doik. What was it about him in particular that made you search for him?
And I think that people made this story out to be a lot more muscular than in fact it is. Photographer haunted by images of the murdered, tracks down mass murder and exposes him and then he's imprisoned or whatever. I mean, it's not quite like that. I mean, it was a chance encounter and I had been carrying around his photograph for about a year and I had talked to people about trying to find him. But I never really believed I would. And in the end, he actually walked up to me. And that was the compelling thing about the story, is that of all the people he shouldn't have walked up to in the end, was actually me, since I was carrying his photograph in my back pocket. I remember standing in the prison, which is now a museum, and looking at these photographs of all his victims, and then looking at his portrait, which is on the wall, and thinking to myself, you know, if there was one person that I could talk to who would be willing to talk, who could explain what had happened and why it had happened, who saw the killing on a day-to-day basis, but also had connections, direct lines, if you like, to the leadership, then perhaps you have some measure of understanding. It's totally understandable that we identify with victims, as we always do. Everyone identifies with victims. It's much more difficult to identify with perpetrators. But that becomes more compelling if you really want to find out ways of being able to perhaps prevent it in the future from happening again. Then we need to try and address the root causes of where this kind of violence or whatever comes from.
So let's go back a little bit. Let's talk about what tool slang the interrogation prison was like when he was there.
Well, tool slang was a former high school. He had a staff of perhaps, I don't know, 300, which would catalogue incoming and outgoing prisoners and get confessions. You had interrogation units. You had guards that would take these prisoners out of the city and to be executed, and you'd have executioners. So there was this small sort of, I suppose, factory of death, if you like. I mean, a really awful, grim place that was highly secretive. It was a conveyor belt of horrors, really.
What was Comrade Doig's role there?
Well, he was the chief administrator. He was the one who was ultimately in control. But the thing about this facility, S21, was just one of many prisons like it. But S21, or Tor Slang, was mainly for the rooting out of enemies from within the party itself. Towards the end, enemies were seen absolutely everywhere. The regime became more and more paranoid, and the monster began to devour itself. And in the case of Doig, I mean, he had to take in not only former mentors and professors and teachers of his, but you also had at least one of his relatives come through.
I'm speaking with Nick Dunlop, photojournalist and author of The Lost Executioner. What's your take on how Comrade Doig became the leader of this? How did he go from being just a teacher to killing his own mentors?
I think it's a very sort of complex series of relationships, which I think is very difficult for us on the outside to understand, because we can't imagine a world without choice. Now, yes, I mean, he was a fanatic. He was deeply committed to the whole business of the Khmer Rouge, that a revolution had to be conducted in this manner, and that killing people was central to that production of a pure agrarian society, which is the ultimate aim of the Khmer Rouge. So I think that he believes in it absolutely wholly. He himself had been a political prisoner in the past and was almost certainly tortured himself. You know, the whole notion of torture being somehow bad, it was considered, I think, probably quite normal. It really was a question of them or us. Either you torture and kill, or you will be tortured and kill.
What was it like when you first finally come face to face with him?
I was stunned. But it wasn't the time nor the place to confront him, because I didn't know what position of authority he held. And then after that, I proposed a story to the Far Eastern Economic Review, a Hong Kong-based magazine. And they said, well, we'd like you to go back and confront him with Nate Thayer. Nate and I had already pre-planned how we were going to approach it. Nate said, I believe you also worked in the security apparatus for the Khmer Rouge during the Khmer Rouge period. And he deflected and started saying, no, I translated children's education books for the Ministry of Education at the time. Then I said, okay, well, look, how about, why don't you write a letter to this doctor, this Senegalese doctor that he worked with in a refugee camp, and I'll deliver it, which I did. And that way we would have a sample of his handwriting, which we could compare to the notations and from the confessions and the prison and things. And he agreed, so he started writing this letter. And he looked, whilst he was writing the letter, he looked at Nate's business card. He turned to me and he said, you know, I think your friend has interviewed Pol Pot and Nguyen Chia and all the others. And I said, well, that's right. And it's then that he realized, and he sort of sat down and he seemed resigned and sort of, it was almost like he exhaled deeply and said, well, it's time to face the past, you know. And he began to this most extraordinary confession, expressing what appeared to be genuine remorse, you know, saying, I've done very bad things, I'm very sorry, many of the people were innocent. My great mistake was that I followed men. Before I used to think men who believed in God were bad people. I mean, it's such an extraordinary confession that I think there have to be elements of truth to what he was saying, that he really did believe that it was wrong. You know, we want to believe that. The more I think about it, and I thought about it a lot over the past years. I mean, whilst he didn't tell 100% the truth, it was certainly, you know, 70 to 80% of the truth. And I think that the fact that he had converted to Christianity was central to, he wouldn't be able to face his past without that. The whole notion that you can redeem yourself in this lifetime, that it isn't, you're not caught up in karmic forces which control you, that actually you can do a U-turn and do better works.
Journalist Nick Dunlop is with us, reflecting on his confrontation with Comrade Doig from the Khmer Rouge regime. What are the lasting ramifications of all this in their society?
Well, you've got a deeply traumatized nation. I mean, you have a country that's suffering from, in some cases, severe post-traumatic stress. People have no faith in the judicial system. The police are very often the source of the abuses that people are most angry about. People are intimidated routinely. Political opponents are silenced, either physically by killing, shooting. The protracted civil war, the genocide, the killings continue to manifest themselves in lots of different ways. And you've also got a whole generation, majority of the population actually has been born since 1979. And they also actually suffer from what is known as secondary trauma, which is they inherit many of the symptoms of their parents. A lot of what had happened is not talked about, so they don't actually have any understanding of where, you know, this comes from. So, you know, they suffer from insomnia, or they suffer from violent outbursts and things like that, low tolerance, all sorts of things. So, I mean, Cambodia is really, I mean, the sort of basic, the fabric of the society has been really torn apart in many ways. And I think although that this book is a really grim book, I think ultimately it's very, very hopeful. Although I haven't got a definitive answer for how do these people do these things or why. If you've read Heart of Darkness or you've seen Apocalypse Now, instead of some guy at the end of some primordial jungle talking about the horrors, that at the end of this journey is a wizened old man who appears to be actually genuinely sorry for what he did and feels bad about it. And we have to believe, I think, people have the capacity to change, that you can be rehabilitated to some extent. Doik should never see the light of day again. I don't believe he should. But I do believe that there's an awful lot that can be learnt from him. And if you're sincere about preventing these things, rather than executing people or banging them away and throwing away the key, you can actually learn from people like Doik. So I think ultimately it's a very hopeful story. I mean, that's why I think it was worth writing a book.
I'm speaking with photojournalist Nick Dunlop. He's the author of The Lost Executioner. What do you take away from all this, if there was a conclusion for you in your quest to find Comrade Doik? Can you draw a conclusion?
I think so. I mean, I think ultimately that people are people. I mean, it sounds a bit glib to say that, but I think that when we talk about today's terrorists, and this may be very unpopular with some of your listeners, but I remember when September 11th occurred, and I was in a hotel room in Thailand watching it on television, and how numb I felt watching this sort of constant 24-hour mindless television that you know, seems so prevalent at the moment, and how I wasn't understanding or feeling anything. It was so abstract to me. And then in the weeks that followed, all these stories of, you know, various people caught up in it, all from the victim's point of view, and it was horrific and shocking and outrageous what had occurred. I mean, there's no question of that. And then this tremendous, you know, sympathy that the world had for what had happened in New York and in Washington. But then it still seemed to me there was something missing. And I remember coming across an article, I think it was maybe Reuters, where they tried to piece together the events leading up for the hijackers of these planes, what they'd been doing in New York. They'd been out to various bars and they'd been drinking. And they got back to the hotel room and they decided this is the night before, that they would try and organize an escort. And they realized that they didn't have enough money. And I thought to myself, how tragically human is that? It's their last night on this earth and this is... they can't even do that. And I was just thinking to myself, I can understand that. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, I agree with anything they did. Far from it. But what I am saying is that, again, these are complicated people. They're not mindless cardboard cutouts of what we consider to be, you know, evil, whatever that means. But they're actually people we can relate to. And I think if you can relate to people, if you really want to prevent these things from happening again, we need to make these kind of human connections with people. We have capacities to commit evil given the set of circumstances as anybody else. So if we can move closer towards that, I think there's tremendous hope. But sadly, I don't see that happening at the moment.
Nick Dunlop received an award for excellence in international journalism from John Hopkins for exposing Comrade Doik. His book, The Lost Executioner, A Journey to the Heart of the Killing Fields, is on the shelves now. Thanks for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nick Dunlop spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. It's 10:29, and we're digging in the dirt in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to innovative ways to keep cows comfortable with bedding, cushioned walkways, misters, and nutritional and medical care. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at a key ingredient. NickDunlop.com.
We've been reporting lately on the leaking tanks of nuclear sludge at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Now it's been determined that those tanks are leaking 3 gallons a day of radioactive waste. We'll get up to date with the latest from Hanford today at noon on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Rotary Club of Des Moines, presenting the 9th Annual Poverty Bay Wine Festival, March 1st through the 3rd at the Landmark on the Sound Event Center in Des Moines. Live music, local food vendors, and wine from over 25 Washington State wineries. More information at dmrotary.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:30.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. I don't know about you, but there are definite signs of spring in my yard. Crocuses are up, the hellebores are blooming, and we have late sarcococca, but late still welcome to have that nice fragrance as you walk in the door.
Mine was late too, Marcy.
But you're happy because it smells good. That's the voice of Marty Wingate. It is Tuesday. Winter is over. Sort of. And our gardening panel, Green Days, here with us once again. Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. You find her at martywingate.com, Landscaping for Privacy is her latest book. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward. He works on habitat restoration and salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Islands. And he co-hosts King County TV's Yard Talk. And I'm not sure if you're a new regular guest, Lisa Taylor, but it's nice to meet you and have you here. Lisa is the Children's Education Program Manager at Seattle Tilth, and that garden is in the Good Shepherd Center.
That's one of our gardens.
Where's the?
We have many all across the city. So if you've been keeping up with Seattle Tilth, we have been on the move. But I work out of the Good Shepherd Center at the
That's where I
county
garden.
And county
all over.
Yeah,
just everywhere.
She's everywhere. She's cloned, and now she's here and taking your gardening calls at 206-543-5869-543-KUOW. So Lisa, since you're here and you work with kids, I just have to start with you. I have this picture of my son. I used to have a big vegetable garden, and he luckily isn't listening, but he was 2, and he was naked running through the garden with a little spade and boots, but it really hasn't stuck. He has no interest. So if I had it all to do over again, what's the first thing that you'd tell me to do to get my child happy in the garden?
Well, you don't know yet that it hasn't stuck because sometimes it takes a while and sometimes they don't show you. So sometimes you have to get the reports from the grandparents or from other folks. My son is 2-year-old naked in the garden.
Yep.
He's now 13. And I wondered, are we doing this right? Because he didn't seem to express much interest when he was at home, but he's like Mark Trail everywhere else. So, So those early introductions are great. And I think that's the best thing to do is just invite the kids out to the garden and try to refrain from using the word yard work.
Right. Let me give you a spade and
do some yard work with me. But just invite them out to participate and, you know, let them be involved as long as they want to be involved and let them play collaterally while you do your gardening. That's a great way to get kids involved.
No, I know, Greg, you have a teenager as well. Does she show any interest?
Not so much. No. My older son, he was exposed also, and he went through a phase, you know, not really interested, but as he's a young adult, he's shown interest then, kind of comes around, and same with teenage daughter, although initially not, you know, early, yes, a lot of interest in nature, then middle phase, not so much, but now she's starting to appreciate a lot of the outdoors.
Our nephew had his own, he expressed interest young, and so he had his own oak barrel garden, and he planted an interesting assortment of things in there. And now at almost 30, he's got the best collection of houseplants. His houseplants look much better than mine. He has no outdoor garden at the moment, but I can see him heading into that. You just have to wait.
Well, and what they express their interest in may not be anything you know anything about. So we did, with my son, we did a little thing about succulent gardens, and it just blew his mind about succulents and how you could pull them out of the ground and stick them in the ground, and they could grow again. And
it so is pretty cool.
Very excited about that particular plant, and then that led to carnivorous plants, which I know nothing about, which led to bonsai, which again I knew nothing about. But that's how he's expressed his interest in, you know, not in the things we're particularly excited about, but still with the growing world and green things. So.
I always found for my son that it had to do with things that he could pick and eat. So that must say something about our houses culturally. But peas, for example, peas, very fun because you can just snatch one and stick it in your mouth.
Yeah.
Berries and as well.
Those flowers that you can pull and sip the nectar from, those are great for kids too. I know that my son and I literally push each other aside, push each other down to get to the Jerusalem sage when it's blooming because, you know, it comes and it's gone. If you don't get the nectar when it's there, you miss
I like
so
that.
So that kind of thing is always really fun with kids.
Well, so kids or grown-ups or plants, we want to hear from you. You're waking up. You've been dormant for the last couple of months and not asking questions. We do have a lot of emails, but we'd love to hear from you at 206-543-5869. Panel, should we just get right down to the questions?
Yes. Sure.
Okay. I showed you all a photo before we went on the air from Minda, who says, please help me figure out how to prune my trees. I think they're a variety of maple. When they fully leaf out, they block the light. You can't see the outside of the house at all. I like them, but they're too full.
So Minda probably didn't plant these trees. Or maybe she did and didn't realize how big they would get. They do look very close to the house. You're right. You pointed that out, Marcy.
Like so, right up against it.
Yeah. So Minda may need to consider taking out a tree. I know it's awful to think about that. But if you are continually whacking back something that is always in the way, it's not going to be a happy situation. Now, having said that, I'll back off from that and say there could be ways to thin out the trees that might allow more light in the summer. The first thing to do is take a look at Cass Turnbull's book, Cass Turnbull's Guide to Pruning. She shows you exactly where to cut and why, and she talks about different kinds of trees and shrubs. So that would be a really good thing to do.
One thing you might also consider is to, when looking at the positioning of those trees, is that she might be able to do both. She might be able to prune them back somewhat now, and then in between them get new appropriately sized plants started so that she doesn't have to clear out the slate to zero and then start with little plants once again. She can start the new ones
and you can before find removing some really good looking narrow plants that wouldn't take up so much space and start so that you still have an interesting garden near the house, but you don't have that giant tree right threatening you.
We have a lot of pruning questions coming through. So I guess is this the time of year for pruning?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Then we'll go to Fremont where Beth joins us. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question. I've started pruning back my apple trees and I'm just curious, can I, you know, prune it basically all the way back or should I leave some of the, you know, younger branches? I mean, part of it is I'm trying to keep them a little smaller so I don't have to get on ladders and everything, you know, and I kind of keep my manageable size. But is it hard on them if I prune them all the way back?
Yeah, generally fruit trees, you're not pruning all the way back. You're more removing, you know, anywhere from, I don't know, a tenth to a quarter of the canopy tops. So if you, when you cut things way back, it's much greater shock to the tree, as well as it, you have a lot more potential for disease, and also you can trigger water sprouts, which are no fun. Which water sprouts are what give that your freshly pruned trees that bad hair day look. When they regrow and they
straight up,
yeah, straight up, and it also really hurts fruit production.
Huh?
Got it. Okay, so I actually then want to just prune sort of at the outer edges of the branches, and not like selectively take certain branches back and leave others long.
Well, you can take whole branches back to where they join another branch. But and apple trees, you know, that it's
there's
different
a lot
pruning
to it.
Fruit trees, because people do leave stubs sometimes because it's the spurs, those little short stems where you'll get the flowers and then the fruit.
Yeah, I wish you'd called a month ago. I would have sent you to our fruit tree pruning class that Seattle Tilth gave. It is a little bit more complicated than just cutting things back. There's a great book called Pruning and Training, the American Horticulture Society. It's a giant book, but I think you probably get it at the library, and I know we have it at the Seattle Tilth Library at the Good Shepherd Center, and it has a lot of good instruction about how to make some cuts and maybe do some training so you can keep that tree within reach, the fruit within reach. I understand it's hard to make a big thing small, and it's hard to keep plants small.
Yeah. You might also want to try take a look at cityfruit.org and see if they have any classes coming.
Ah,
yeah.
Well,
it's coming to the end of fruit tree pruning time. So,
all right. Well, Beth, good luck with that. Sounds like your work's cut out for you. Gardening. You guys are turning on the radio, and Rico says, welcome back, gang.
Oh, hi, Rico. Hey.
Green Days is back. Our phone number, 206-543-5869. Another pruning question. Rico has grapes and trumpet vines. Should I prune them now or wait until when? And how far back on the trumpet vines? I've yet to see blooms, and I've had these things for 5 years.
Gosh, trumpet vines really like hot weather. And so
probably why you're not getting any
and they don't bloom until summer. And I'm saying this, I'm not really sure about trumpet vine, which is campsis. Usually when something doesn't bloom until July or August, it blooms on new wood, which means you can cut them back and you would still get growth that would produce flowers. But if you've got no flowers and you have been pruning them late, then maybe that isn't the case.
Mm-hmm. What about grapes?
I think now it's kind of getting to the edge where the sap's starting to flow.
We're looking at spring, folks.
Yeah, yeah. Things are warming up. Soil temperatures are warming up and things are starting to happen.
That's so optimistic.
Yeah. And it could snow tomorrow. But
yeah.
Yeah. That would be my son's wish, but not mine. I don't know. I sort of think you could prune a little bit for size. I'd be careful not to take too much wood off of that. If it's way overgrown and crazy, you might just kind of make a little plan. We never want to take more than about a fifth of the growth off of anything when we prune it. So usually
except
I got to prune
grapes, boy.
Yeah.
Except
right now it could just sap and
now
drip and cry
late.
For
and
a month.
And so WSU Extension has a great booklet, an extension publication on pruning grapes. So look online. You can find it online. And also the campsis, the trumpet vine may very well be in Cass's pruning book. So I would take a look at that and you can get a copy at your local bookstore or you can go to the Miller Library at the Center for Urban Horticulture.
Rico, good luck with that. We are talking with our Green Days panel, Marty Wingett and Greg Rayburn and Lisa Taylor here from Seattle Tilth and a lot of callers because, like me, they're like, whoa, crocuses are actually blooming in the yard. And the birds are singing. That's how I know it's really spring. In Tukwila, hi, Paul. Thanks for hanging in there. You're on the air.
Hey, you're welcome. Hey, I have a question about hellebores, and I've heard you guys mention that particular genre, I guess, if you want to describe it as that, over the years, and didn't really know much about it. There was an article this past weekend in the Wall Street Journal, a fairly extensive article about hellebores and how popular they're becoming and how hardy and, just adaptable they are. Just some thoughts on that. If you want to touch on that topic, I'd be interested to hear your comments.
Yeah, hellebores for a long time were a specialty plant. Gardeners went crazy over the hybrid, what we used to call Helleborus orientalis. So they were pretty flowers, and they came in white or purple or speckled, and they hung their little flower heads down so you never saw the flower when it bloomed. It was rather annoying. Now, lately, in the last few years, other species of hellebores have been bred, and they're coming out with all these fabulous selections that, just like that article you read said, they're tough, they bloom for a very long time. They come, their flowers face outward or upward so you can see them. And they just look good all the time. Pink frost is now blooming in my garden. Pink frost is probably the winner. Everybody just oohs and ahs over it. Joseph Limper is a white one. Ivory Prince is a gorgeous. These are all really hardy.
But they also, I have a lot of hellebores in my yard because they grow in partial sun.
Yes.
So you don't need full-on sun to grow them there. And they start early,
yes,
some of them.
The oriental hellebores will start earlier than that. They're the ones that people usually clip the leaves off of early because the leaves start, they flop onto the ground. They look a little ratty after a year or so.
Well, that might be you. Would new, be clipping
yeah.
leaves. I haven't done that. They grow back anyway.
Yes, they do.
And they're very exciting. So, Paul, thanks for that. And you can start with one. And then you who knows, you might just be inundated with love for that. Catherine's in Ballard, and you're looking to block out your neighbors, Catherine?
Yes, actually, not so much my neighbors, but a garage in that I can see through the back window of my kitchen. But I have a few other factors in that we also have an amazing old magnolia tree in our backyard. We've also got some power lines overhead in the alley, so I wouldn't want to plant something that would interfere with those. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions.
So you have somebody else's garage that you're looking at out your kitchen window. That's it?
Yeah, that's the main thing. But I want to make sure that if I planted something, it wouldn't take away too much light from our magnolia tree, which is beautiful. But
right.
Unfortunately, doesn't block the garage.
Yeah, right. Too bad. I would, if this is where you see the annoying thing from your kitchen window, I would make sure that whatever you chose covered up only that much of it. Sometimes we only see an unwanted sight from one place. And so if you can choose a couple of small, you could even choose an arborvitae, you know, which is usually people plant 40 of them in a row and then half of them die. But you may only need two or three. Plant them in a cluster so that get somebody out there, move the plants around in the pots. You stand inside at your kitchen window and say, yes, move that one over there more. They only grow 2 or 3 feet wide, and you may only need 6 feet because your kitchen window isn't that big. So
you might want to, Catherine, check out Marty's book, Landscaping for Privacy, because I bet that you address these issues.
I talk about garage walls, and there are plant lists in the back. There are lists of narrow plants and lists of evergreen, broadleaf evergreens, and all sorts of things you might be able to choose.
Oh, brilliant. That's great.
Okay. So good luck with that, and have fun planting. Lisa, you mentioned that the soil's warming up.
It is.
So what does that mean I can plant right now?
Well,
no vegetables yet.
I am resisting putting anything in the soil in my garden just yet because the springs have been long and cold here, but it's certainly time to get some little seedlings started. So I have started my tomatoes inside, and I have collard greens and 6 different kinds of lettuces and some tatsoi that's about ready to be eaten. And so a lot of those early spring plants, if getting them started on your own is kind of an obstacle, we have a solution for you because Seattle Tilth puts on a early March sale that's for all your spring veg. So
when is that?
That's in March on the 16th. It's a Saturday. You can certainly check our website out for details of where it'll be. It's in a new site down in the Soto area.
Oh.
So you'll have to find us this year, but it'll be covered and lots of great selection and all your needs for your early garden.
Well, speaking of vegetables, Jacob writes in, howdy, my name is Jacob, and I've got a question about starting veggies from seeds in an apartment container garden.
Right.
I've decided to plant snow peas, green onions, and bell peppers all from seed. I've got my trellis set up for the snow peas. They've just started sprouting in my little improvised greenhouse. Exciting.
Yeah.
But the green onions aren't sprouting yet, even though they were planted at the same time, and they're in a separate mini greenhouse in the same conditions. Why? And also, should I plant bell peppers in a hanging planter? I don't have a lot of horizontal space, but plenty of vertical real estate.
Right. Well, peas and onions are a different family, and all seeds sprout at different times. I'm going to say the onions are a little bit longer to sprout, maybe up to 3 weeks, depending on your heat. So if he's got a place to bring them inside, he can get them sprout a little bit faster. If he's just outside, he's just going to have to wait for Mother Nature to do her work. As far as the pepper, I would do that inside, keep it inside.
They're not so happy here.
Until
May.
Plant it up. Plant it up successively. Keep it under some lights until the end of May when you can plant it out. Container?
Well, maybe not. But I believe aren't there small peppers, mild and hot, that would go well in a container?
Sure.
And you could just put it in a hanging basket and it would be easy to pick. And they'll be smaller peppers than you would get the big.
Some of those little little mini chocolate bells or things like that produce the smaller peppers.
But don't they need heat? I've not ever had any good luck getting them to just set a fruit.
Yeah, full sun for 8 to 10 hours. If you're fooling yourself that it's almost that sunny, you're probably just
It's not.
It's denial.
It's not.
Yeah,
that's why.
On an apartment patio, depending on how you're oriented, you might have really good heat in a container. Yeah. That could be excellent pepper growth.
Up against the wall. Yeah.
Well, Jacob, good luck with that. And then bring in, you know, tithe. We want a tenth of all this.
Hold off on the peppers, though. It's too cold.
543-KUOW is our phone number, or toll free 1-800-289-5869. Peg in Shoreline, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about my winter jasmine.
Okay.
I have a very large winter jasmine, unfortunately, still in the nursery pot after 4 to 5 years. It's quite a large pot, however.
I've never done that before.
I can't plant in the ground. I have a apartment container garden. Mm-hmm. And it's really lovely, and it's blooming as we speak, but I don't know what to do about it, whether I can actually prune it. Do I need to give it away to someone who can actually plant it? Or what can I do? It's kind of spread.
Yeah, it does spread.
It's rather pretty.
Yeah.
But I just know it must be terribly root-bound after this long.
Well, you could always, if it's in one of the black nursery pots, you can always pot it up into a pretty container if you want. You could do a little root pruning when that happens. You can prune a winter jasmine, and just as it finishes blooming is a great time to do that. I have seen it does spread. That's what it likes to do. It's kind of a ground cover. And I have seen it grown up against a fence before, so if you're able to maybe grow it up against a wall, it would look pretty. It would almost look like an espaliered shrub. Or, yes, indeed, I'm sure there's someone you know that would just be delighted to get this winter jasmine. So you could always start all over again with a smaller one.
Yeah. So what about if I just leave it and is it going to die off, or, you know, do they have a huge root system?
Well, not in that pot. It doesn't have a huge root system right now. And eventually, if you keep it in the nursery pot, there won't be any soil left. And there's probably not a whole lot of it left now. It's probably just mostly roots. So I'd say, you know, maybe not this year, but you will come to a point where the plant starts to decline because it just can't. It has no nutrients and no way of taking up water. It just has giant roots.
Well, Jasmine for her yard, if anyone can carry this huge thing.
Okay. Peg's offering.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call. We're talking with our Green Days panel, Marty Wingett, Lisa Taylor, Greg Rayburn, and you at 206-543-5869. Now, I have seen people out working in their gardens, so everybody, you know, you were talking about, you know, sap starting to flow, Lisa, but I think it flows in gardeners too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, your friend's like, yay, I'm outside. Amy's in Columbia City. Hi, thanks for joining us, Amy.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So a few weeks ago, I heard Lisa talking about having giant kale plants in her yard, and I have very similar plants that I planted last March that are as tall as I am, and I think she mentioned cutting them down and that they would re-sprout again from the ground. Is that something I can do now?
What kind of kale?
It's dinosaur kale.
Oh, some dinosaur kale. So you've been just harvesting it up. It kind of looks like a palm tree right now?
Yes. Yes, that's what I have too.
Well, that's on its way to make seed and flowers. I don't know that you're going to necessarily stop that. You can try with one, cut it off and see if it'll sprout back. They'll be small sprouts. Might be nice for stir fry and that kind of thing. It's probably already making some new little sprouts laterally where you've pulled off the leaves. And if you just watch in a few weeks, you're going to have a big old flush of yellow flowers, and they're delicious.
Really?
Yeah, they're so good. If you like kale leaves, you'll love the kale flowers. And the insects that are out in the early spring also love those. So watch those flowers. Hummingbirds love sipping the nectar, and children love to sip the nectar of brassica flowers. They're delicious.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, but if she wants new kale, she...
Yeah, it's, you know, it's time is going to come sooner or later. And usually when it warms up, things that have been growing for a season and made it through the winter will start to make seed flowers and then seeds. I would say try it with one and know that chances are it's going to bolt.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Amy. I have been enjoying my kale all winter long.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, you're going to love the flowers. They're so good.
I'll look forward to seeing them.
So good.
Rebecca writes, so glad to have you back. I'm not a fan of lawns, but I do have a bit that I have proudly cultivated under the shifting shadow of a large Douglas fir. I use organic methods and hands-on weed control. I introduced my baby ducks last summer to the mix, and the combination of duck poop and frequent rinsing of said poop has agreed nicely with my lawn. Then as the fall weather got wetter and the ducks got bigger, the diminishing return stressed my grass. I have large patches of dirt. I want to plant some seed to reforest the area before the smaller flock of ducks are reintroduced. Is it too early? I should have done it in the fall. Wasn't in the cards.
No, you can still, what I like to do in the spring, if you want to rejuvenate your lawn, is you can, it may be getting a bit compacted as well. So really kind of a nice routine is to go through and aerate, then top dress with some compost. And in the case of this, you already have some fertilizer, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you've increased the good tilth of the soil. You know, the duck poop isn't really enough volume to really do that.
Depends how many ducks you have.
Yeah.
Well, aren't you and supposed to make holes in your
lawn? The good aeration isn't the little spikes that you walk around the yard in, because if you think about it, those spikes just go in and they just compress the soil around where you've made the hole. But the good aerators remove a plug and they leave what looks like goose droppings all over the lawn when you're done. But then you just rake them up, spread them out with a rake, and the rain also does a good job of that, and rake in compost. And then you can just overseed the area. And you don't want to do it when it's really wet. Really, April is a great month to do that.
Okay, so she needs to just hang in there for another month.
And a grazing schedule for the ducks, because they're just going to do it again.
Right. Yeah. I would think so.
A little bit of a grazing schedule.
Yeah, rotate yeah. them through different parts of the grass. Yeah.
Before we end our segment, here's a very great question. Jessica wants to know where I can find a good planting calendar for the Seattle area and wants to know what zone we are. Five, right?
Well, eight. I happen to have...
Eight. Wait. Lisa's got one.
Eight, we are zone eight. We are eight. Sunset zone five, just to confuse you all.
Yeah. Best planting guide that I've found is the Maritime Northwest Garden Guide. It's a book that's was compiled by Seattle Tilth. It's been out since 1998, and it's a month-to-month planting calendar for this area.
So what's the difference between zone 8 and zone 5 and sunset?
They look at things differently. Sunset takes into consideration rainfall and topography. Zone 8 is a USDA minimum average winter temperature.
Okay. Why can't they just have the same number?
No, it's too. It would be too easy, Marcy. let me just say a word for the Arboretum plant sale on Saturday. They're selling all of the New Zealand plants from their flower show garden. At great prices on Saturday at the Arboretum. So
that's at the Arboretum. The Tilth early spring sale is going to be in March like vanished place that we're going to have to find.
It's not going to be hard to find, but it's not at the Good Shepherd Center. So don't come looking for us there.
And you're raising your hand,
Greg.
Yeah,
and also the Krukeberg Botanical Garden, MSK Nursery, there is having a rain garden plant sale this weekend. So
it is really time.
Oh, my gosh. And then on the... On the 9th, a week from Saturday, Northwest Horticultural Society has its early spring sale, and I'll be there at the Center for Urban Horticulture.
There you go. Your months are mapped out. Now, Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. You can find her at martywingate.com. Greg Rayburn's on TV as co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk and roving around Vashon and Maury Islands helping to save habitat. Lisa Taylor is Children's Education Program Manager at Seattle Till. Thanks, all three of you,
Thank
for
you.
Being here.
Thanks.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsati, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. Danielle Anthony Goodwin's the intern. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher here on 94.9 KUOW.
An alliance of Egyptian opposition parties has decided to boycott parliamentary elections in protest of an election law they say favors the Muslim Brotherhood. That and more of today's news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Citizen University, a conference on the art of great citizenship featuring playwright and screenwriter Tony Kushner on the lessons of the film Lincoln and dozens of luminary speakers. March 23rd at Seattle Center. Registration at citizenuniversity.us.
Say you have a baby.
Did you see the owl?
Yeah, my tail.
You raise her with love.
One day I'm going to be able to tell her, you can do this. Push yourself.
The kid's going to turn out exactly as you planned, right?
Yeah.
Hold on here. It would be nice if life was like that, but life isn't like that. Life is hard.
Are we bound by our DNA, or can a parent change it? That's on the next Radio Lab.
Friday. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.